Welcome to the reading of the Courier Journal for Sunday, May 7th, 2023, which is brought to our Louisville listeners via Louisville Public Media. The Courier Journal is donated to Radio I by the Herald Leader. As a reminder, Radio I is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Your reader for today is Melody Ryan. We'll begin with the WHAS local forecast. Mostly cloudy with a shower in spots this morning, followed by a thunderstorm in parts of the area this afternoon. Plenty of clouds tonight with a couple of showers and a thunderstorm. Mostly cloudy and humid tomorrow with a couple of heavy thunderstorms. Tuesday, mostly cloudy and humid with a thunderstorm in the area in the afternoon. Wednesday, mostly sunny and warm. Today, high 80, mostly cloudy, a shower. Tonight, low 64, a shower and thunderstorm. Monday, high 83, low 64, humid with heavy thunderstorms. Tuesday, high 80, low 61, mostly cloudy and humid. Wednesday, high 83, low 61, mostly sunny and warm. Thursday, high 80, low 65, partly sunny. Friday, high 80, low 65, cloudy, a stray thunderstorm. It won't be a neighborhood anymore. Residents push to limit short-term rentals as downtown Airbnbs gain solid foothold. By Bailey Loosemore. When Christy Ashby put her house in Phoenix Hill up for sale last year, she quickly got four offers well above the asking price, all from investors wanting to make it an Airbnb. Nearly 30 homes in the neighborhood had already been converted to short-term rentals, capitalizing on the area's proximity to downtown distilleries, hospitals, and event venues. And while Ashby said she preferred to sell the house to a family who would live there, she couldn't pass up the money investors were willing to pay. It's a situation that's left a bad taste for the long-term Phoenix Hill Neighborhood Association president, who has since joined a group of residents pushing Louisville Metro Council members to tighten regulations on short-term rentals that are booked through websites such as Airbnb and VRBO. The rentals, residents say, have begun taking over several urban neighborhoods, driving up housing costs and causing headaches for neighbors who feel like they're losing a sense of community. In a nice little neighborhood like ours, it's going to be too expensive, says Lisa Santos, who lives in Irish Hill just east of downtown. It won't be a neighborhood anymore. It's going to be a hotel district. Santos is a member of the Citizens Coalition for Land Development Code Reform, which recently sent a letter to Metro Council members with a list of proposed changes for how the city handles short-term rentals. A representative with Louisville Forward said the city's Economic and Community Development Department is already looking for ways to improve rental regulations. And Councilmember Ja'Cory Arthur has proposed a moratorium on new rentals in three neighborhoods, Butchertown, Phoenix Hill, and Clifton Heights, while the changes are being considered. Meanwhile, one local short-term rental operator said he thinks Louisville's current ordinances already provide balance for rental owners and residents, and he's concerned more regulations would hamper an industry he says is led by small businesses. The rules are prohibiting people from taking over communities, said Benjamin Brainard, who owns 11 rentals under the name Hollyhock Suites. To increase them, I don't think would be good for Louisville and our hospitality as a community. Where are Louisville's Airbnbs? More than 1,100 short-term rentals are registered in Louisville, with the vast majority located in and around downtown. Nearly 150 short-term rentals are registered in the Central Business District, while 137 are registered in Butchertown and Phoenix Hill, according to a Courier Journal analysis of public data. Other neighborhoods with higher concentrations of short-term rentals include Old Louisville Limerick, 73, Clifton Irish Hill, 63, Cherokee Triangle, 60, Shelby Park, 47, Germantown Paristown, 43, and the Highlands, 41. Nearly two-thirds of all rentals are not host-occupied, meaning they are solely used for temporary stays of 30 days or less. That's a concern for Santos, who said she initially believed most short-term rentals would be owned by a young person trying to pay the mortgage on their first house. Now it's like these people that are super uncooperative, she said. Rentals that are not host-occupied are more likely to have noise complaints and to diminish value in residential neighborhoods, residents who spoke with the Courier Journal said. But Hollyhock Suites owner Brainard disagrees. Short-term rental owners want their properties to stand out to guests, he said, so they often try to make them as gorgeous as possible, both inside and out. Plus, Airbnb pays well and allows us to reinvest in the property, he said. It's one of the things that helps the neighborhood. How does Louisville regulate short-term rentals? Since 2016, Louisville has required all short-term rentals to register annually with the city, providing information on where they're located and who owns them. Louisville employees review each short-term rental application before it's registered to make sure it meets zoning, occupancy, and other requirements, and code enforcement officers can cite rentals operating without a registration, planning manager Joe Haberman said by email. Booking platforms are also not supposed to allow non-registered rentals on their websites. City employees can revoke a rental's registration if it's found to have violated Louisville's laws. But Haberman said relatively few registrations have been rescinded because most hosts, with regulations, follow the rules and resolve issues before revocation. Rules include providing proof of residency if a rental is host-occupied, meeting city maintenance codes, and not having civil or criminal complaints such as noise violations or drug activity. Starting in 2019, short-term rentals were also required to receive conditional use permits if they wanted to operate without a host as a residentially zoned properties. Those rentals are not supposed to be within 600 feet of each other, though the Board of Zoning Adjustment has power to approve permits with exceptions. In 2022, short-term rental owners applied for 101 conditional use permits, 60 of which were approved and 22 denied, according to city data. What do residents want to change? One main concern for residents in urban neighborhoods is the conditional use permitting process. Most properties in Phoenix Hill and Butchertown are not zoned residential, meaning operators can open short-term rentals there without needing a public or permit or public input that's required to get one. Members of the Citizens Coalition for Land Development Code Reform say they'd like that to change. Instead of requiring permits only for residential properties, they'd like the city to require them for all short-term rentals. We're not against short-term rentals, said Allison H. Johnson, president of the Clifton Heights Community Council. We're saying they need to be regulated, and the regulations need to be enforced. Metro Council President Marcus Winkler, who sponsored the 2019 permit ordinance, said he's open to revising it to make sure neighborhoods are not overrun by short-term rentals. Folks in planning and design have found, now that it's been on the books for a couple of years, opportunities to strengthen the intent of the law and how it has been exploited, Winkler said. I would expect some logical changes. In a letter to council members, the Citizens Coalition also requested the city, 1, enforce the 600-foot rule for permitted rentals without exceptions, 2, lower the short-term rental occupancy limit, 3, change the definition of a host to someone who lives at the property, 4, disqualify applicants that have been operating without a permit, and 5, divert short-term rental taxes and fees to the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. We think if they do everything on there that it will make it manageable and still allow people to have a short-term rental if they are a good operator, Santos said. Brainard said he's already shifted where he opens new rentals after being denied a conditional use permit for being within 600 feet of another residential rental, and he believes Louisville's laws are already working to not saturate neighborhoods. I get the desire to maintain the community, but I do think we have an even set of laws that help protect the community and small businesses, he said. Teenage girls in U.S. are in crisis, health official says. Kentucky leads nation in drug use, depression, by Krista Johnson. This story discusses suicide and mental health issues. If you're in crisis, help is available. Call the National 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline by dialing 988 or chatting online. If you or someone you know is in crisis, you can get help through the 24/7 crisis text line by texting HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741741. Chat with someone online at crisistextline.org. Teenage girls in Kentucky and across the nation are experiencing suicidal thoughts, dating violence, and a sense of hopelessness at higher rates than ever before, a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention survey shows. The survey results, the first since the COVID-19 pandemic began, have alarmed health officials, leaving them worried about the well-being of the nation's girls, who self-report these issues much more often than their male classmates. These data show a distressing picture, said Deborah Howery, the CDC's chief medical officer, after the results were released in February. America's teen girls are engulfed in a growing wave of sadness, violence, and trauma. The CDC's Youth Risk Behavior Survey has been done every 2 years since the early 1990s, and the latest results reflect data collected in the fall of 2021. Nationally, more than 17,200 students in public and private high schools answered the survey. In Kentucky, 2,178 students in 52 public high schools completed the survey. The data is scientifically weighted and can be used to make accurate generalizations about young people statewide, according to the CDC. It is one of the few data sources that gives us the numbers and information that we need to understand the behaviors teens are participating in and what they need, said Stephanie Bunge, who works in the Kentucky Department of Education's Supervision of District Support. Here are some of the disturbing results for Kentucky girls. Did Kentucky girls use drugs more than boys? The national results showed higher rates of alcohol, vape, and drug use among girls than boys. In Kentucky, girls only drastically outranked boys in drug usage when it came to taking a prescription pain medication without a doctor's authorization or using it in a way not prescribed. Girls reported doing so at nearly twice the rate of boys, at 13.6% compared to 7.1%. Girls also reported using weed and drinking alcohol in the past 30 days at a slightly higher rate than boys, with 12.8% of girls saying they used weed and 19.8% using alcohol, compared to 10.9% and 14.4% respectively for boys. Other drug use questions showed that nearly 1 in 5 students, or 17.5% of girls and 18.7% of boys, said they had been offered, sold, or given an illegal drug on school property in the last 12 months. Just over 1% of girls and just under 2% of boys answered that they had used heroin, meth, or injected an illegal drug at least once in their lifetime. Are Kentucky girls suicidal and/or depressed? Girls reported higher rates of suicidal thoughts, suicide attempts, and a pervasive sense of hopelessness. In 2015, the study showed 10.6% of Kentucky teens had seriously considered attempting suicide in the previous 12 months. The latest results show that rate jumped to 13.7%, but among girls, that rate was far higher. About 1 in 4 Kentucky girls, or 24.7%, had serious thoughts about suicide in the past year of the survey, compared to 13.7% of boys. Among middle school girls, 29.9% of girls reported having those thoughts. Suicide attempts were twice as high among girls at 12.3% than boys at 6.1%, equating to about 1 out of every 10 Kentucky girls. Girls made plans about how they would attempt suicide more, 18.7% compared to 10.8%. In middle school, the results to this question were even more alarming, with 21.6% of girls and 14.8% of boys reporting having made such a plan. Girls also report higher rates of suicide attempts that required professional medical attention. In the previous 12 months, 4.3% of girls reported having made a suicide attempt that resulted in an injury, poisoning, or overdose that had to be treated by a doctor or nurse, compared to 1.9% of boys. And when asked if during the last 12 months they had felt sad or hopeless almost every day for more than 2 weeks in a row, so that they stopped doing some usual activity, 51% of girls said yes, compared to 26.9% of boys. Are Kentucky girls being sexually abused? Nationally, almost 14% of teen girls said they were forced to have sex, compared to 11% 2 years earlier. States have the ability to alter what questions are asked in the survey, and in Kentucky, the survey does not directly ask about rape. But the responses by Kentucky girls still showed alarming rates of sexual abuse. Kentucky girls were asked if they had, in the previous 12 months, experienced sexual dating violence, defined as being forced by someone they were dating or going out with to do sexual things, like kissing, touching, or being physically forced to have sexual intercourse, that they did not want to do. Just under 19% of girls said yes. The results also show about 1 out of 10 Kentucky girls have been abused by an adult. Ask if an adult or person at least 5 years older made them do sexual things they did not want to do, including kissing, touching, or sexual intercourse. 12.3% of girls and 6.5% of boys answered yes. What might be the cause of these results? In October 2021, officials sounded the alarm about the toll the COVID-19 pandemic had been taking on the country's youngest residents. With the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and the Children's Hospital Association declaring a national state of an emergency in children's mental health. Young people have endured so much throughout this pandemic, and while much of the attention is often placed on its physical health consequences, we cannot overlook the escalating mental health crises facing our patients, AAP President Lee Savio Beers said in a statement then. Today's declaration is an urgent call to policymakers at all levels of government. We must treat this mental health crisis like the emergency it is. In response to the survey results, Kentucky's Boonch said girls have always reported a higher rate of poor mental health compared to boys. Nationally, that trend is the same, and its cause has been debated. Whether girls are more aware of their mental health woes, more likely to report them, or if they are simply struggling more. Kentucky girls also reported more verbal abuse than boys, with 17.2% saying a parent or an adult in their home most of the time or always swore at them, insulted them, or put them down, compared to 8.3% of boys. Aside from the pandemic, officials have repeatedly pointed to the negative impact of social media on young people. Kentucky's largest school district, along with at least 10 others, recently filed lawsuits against major social media companies for allegedly leading to the mental health crisis among America's youth. When it comes to screen time, Kentucky girls did report spending more time on devices. 78.9% of girls reported 3-plus hours of screen time per day, compared to 68.9% of boys. CDC officials recommended schools work to provide more access to mental health services for students, better training for teachers, and enforcement of anti-harassment policies. This article is accompanied by a boxed text entitled Survey Results. Questions showed 35.1% of girls and 15.5% of boys reported having missed one or more days of school in the previous 30 days because their mental health was not good due to stress, anxiety, and/or depression. 40.5% of girls and 16.7% of boys reported their mental health was most of the time or always not good during the previous 30 days. 30% of girls and 13% of boys reported having purposely hurt themselves by cutting or burning without wanting to die in the previous 12 months. Community Event Offers Solutions by Veda Morgan. Why are young athletes dying, and what can we do to make sidelines safer? Those are the questions that inspired a Courier Journal investigation into sudden death in high school sports. You can ask your own questions and get answers at a special community event the Courier Journal is holding in partnership with Spalding University at 6 p.m. May 17 at Spalding University College Center Ballroom, 812 South 2nd Street. The Safer Sidelines event will include sports safety resources and solutions. Courier Journal reporter Stephanie Kudzim, who has followed sideline safety for the past decade, will moderate the panel, which will include High School Athletic Association Commissioner Julian Tackett, Matthew Mangine Sr., co-founder of the Matthew Mangine Jr. One Shot Foundation, Dr. Alma Maddox, Program Director for the Spalding University Master of Science and Athletic Training Program, and State Representative Kim Moser, Republican Taylor Mill, who worked on recent Kentucky sports safety legislation. The event is free, but registration is required. The link to register is https://usatn.enmotive.com/events/safer-sidelines-2023. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. Free parking is available in the adjacent lot. The event is in response to the Courier Journal's investigation, which revealed that at least 200 students nationwide have died playing high school sports in the last 10 years, with the majority dying from head trauma, cardiac arrest, or heat illness. Between 2009 and 2020, four Kentucky athletes died of sudden cardiac arrest. In Lexington, Star Efaccio died in 2017 after he collapsed while playing basketball at Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School, and an AED wasn't brought to him until 9 minutes later. And in Northern Kentucky, Matthew Mangine Jr. collapsed and died in 2020 during off-season soccer conditioning at St. Henry District High School in Northern Kentucky. In Kudstim's 7-month investigation, the Courier-Journal found: 1. Most states and thousands of high schools don't have cold standard policies in place to protect young athletes. 2. The cost of life-saving equipment, often used as a reason not to implement safeguards, is a tiny fraction of what schools spend on athletics. 3. Legislation meant to fix the problem has been routinely defeated or watered down. 4. Policies and laws that are in place have little enforcement and are often ignored. The Safer Sidelines event will explore proven ways to protect student athletes. If you have a question for our panelists, email them to skuzydym@courier-journal.com or submit them when you register online. Neighborhoods with the most Airbnbs. Lion's share of rentals in Louisville's urban areas by Bailey Loosemore. Short-term rentals are rapidly multiplying in Louisville, with a few urban neighborhoods shouldering most of the increase. In recent years, denser areas surrounding downtown have seen hundreds of homes and apartments turned into rentals, booked for short periods through companies such as Airbnb or VRBO. Residents living near the rentals say the proliferation has led to increased noise complaints, higher housing costs, and a loss of their sense of community. And they're asking Metro Council members to tighten regulations on where and how short-term rentals can operate. To get a sense of what's happening across Louisville neighborhoods, the Courier-Journal reviewed data from the city's public short-term rental registry and business portal. Here's what the data shows. Short-term rentals clustered in urban neighborhoods. The majority of short-term rentals are located downtown by far. The Courier-Journal mapped all registered rentals by neighborhood using census tracts to determine where each one is located. Neighborhoods with the most rentals as of late April were 1. Central Business District with 145, 2. Butchertown, Phoenix Hill, 137, 3. Old Louisville, Limerick, 73, 4. Clifton, Irish Hill, 63, 5. Cherokee Triangle, 60, 6. Shelby Park, 47, 7. Germantown, Paristown, 43, 8. Highlands, 41, 9. Audubon Park, Camp Taylor, 38, and 10. Schnitzelberg, 36. Dozens of rentals in and near downtown are apartments within large complexes, such as the 800 Tower on 4th Street, but many others are single-family homes that have been converted to permanent rentals. For example, 33 homes in the Butchertown Phoenix Hill area are now rentals that are not occupied by a host or owner. Most rentals are not host-occupied. Nearly two-thirds of registered rentals are not host-occupied, meaning no one lives there permanently. In the Central Business District, not a single rental is host-occupied, while only 7 rentals in the Butchertown Phoenix Hill are host-occupied. Neighborhoods further from downtown have higher rates of rentals that are host-occupied, including 92% in Cherokee Seneca and 90% in Belknap. Most conditional use permits are approved. Short-term rental owners are required to receive conditional use permits if they wish to start a rental on a residential property without a host living there. Rentals issued such permits cannot be located within 600 feet of another rental requiring a permit. In 2022, Louisville received 101 conditional use permit applications for short-term rentals. Of those, 60 were approved and 22 were denied. Louisville Food Truck Clinic. One-stop shop provides all permits to vendors. Streamlined process could mean a flood of new food options. By Dahlia Gabor. For the first time, aspiring food truck owners will be able to get their permits all at once. And downtown Louisvillians will benefit, too. Several city agencies have teamed up to launch a pop-up food truck clinic offering a one-stop shop where food vendors can get the green light from the Louisville Metro Department of Public Health and Wellness, Louisville Division of Fire, and Jefferson County Fire Service, and alcohol beverage control to legally sell food and drinks to the public. Every Thursday between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. from now until October 19, food trucks and other mobile vendors can stop by the alley at Armory Place behind the Metro Development Center at 444 South 5th Street to get their permits to operate. Some of our city's favorite local restaurants started as food trucks, Mayor Craig Greenberg said in a release. Food trucks add diversity, help connect neighborhoods, and attribute economic vibrancy to our community as a foodie destination. We want to support them by making the permitting process as easy and streamlined as we can. The idea for the clinic came from ABC Director Brad Silveira, who said the clinic cuts the red tape out of the process. Imagine how hard it is to get one government department together, Silveira said. We all three came together and said we need to do this. It's like the stars aligned properly to make sure this red tape would be cut. There's also an amnesty period included for the food truckers, waiving the Jefferson County permit fees for the duration of the program. Kentucky State permit fees will still apply. Opening a food truck is often the first step food and beverage purveyors take to opening a restaurant. Troy King, president of the Louisville Food Truck Association, said he often has to educate first-time mobile food vendors on the permitting process required to open. More than 200 food trucks operate in Jefferson County. Now, King said, new trucks will be able to come out of the woodwork and open for business. King said this kind of program is particularly helpful for immigrants looking to get into the food business. On Thursday, when the program launched, the Venezuelan truck Alchemy and the Colombian coffee truck Con Ají y Café were in attendance. That diversity is what every city needs, King said. The food truck scene here is exploding. We're getting new members every week for the Food Truck Association. It's my goal to make it accessible for everyone and make it so that it's easy for you to get into the business. Vendors who would like to stop by the food truck clinic must register. To learn more about the food trucks and mobile vending permits, visit Louisville's Food Truck and Mobile Vending Permit website. This concludes readings for the first section of the Courier-Journal for this Sunday, May 7th, 2023. Stay tuned to the Metro section following immediately. Your reader has been Melody Ryan. Now to continue reading from the Courier-Journal for Sunday, May 7th, 2023. We will turn to the Metro section. Your reader is Melody Ryan. Now we turn to the obituaries. We read only the name, age, and city. If you would like further information on any of the obituaries, please call us during the weekdays at 859-422-6390, and we will be glad to read the entire obituary for you. I will repeat that number at the end of the listings. Jeffrey Todd Adams, 59, Sanders. Pauline Phelps Bays, 86, No City. Emily Grace Barnesfather, 76, Louisville. Alice Snyder Beaven, 93, Louisville. Frederick Paul Bearson, 78, Louisville. Paula Best, 74, New Albany. Charlesie Barsdorfer, 78, Stanford. Rosalie S. Boddy, 85, Louisville. Kieran Orion Bradley, 13, Louisville. Myrna L. Marshall Brame, 73, Louisville. Rosalind Elaine Bridges, 58, Louisville. Joyce Ann Brown, 85, Scotts Valley. Verdi May Chambers, 86, Louisville. Lloyd K. Chapman, 64, Louisville. Michael Brian Ratliff Sissel, 41, Louisville. Marianne Sissel, 75, Louisville. Mary Hines Clark, 76, Sellersburg. Arnetha M. Cobbs, 82, Louisville. Justin Collins, 16, Mount Washington. Jack Compton, 84, Marysville, Indiana. Esker Leon Coots, 92, Louisville. Robert Wesley Crenshaw, 84, Lawrenceburg. Donald Lee Daniels, 82, Louisville. Alfred Doug Dickens, 72, Crestwood. Edward Arthur Dillinger, 73, Louisville. Laura Dunn, 53, Louisville. Kenneth Schalk Eberhardt, 69, Louisville. Dr. Keith P. Eichen, no city, no age. Wallace Arthur Wally Inslee, 75, Louisville. Louis Sonny L.D. Exley, 85, Mount Washington. Mary Catherine Brinson Farone, 88, Madison. Rick Allen Favreau, Sr., 70, Louisville. Edna Ferguson, 76, Noblick. Don Ferriel, 71, Louisville. Ryan Daniel Fisher, 40, New Washington, Indiana. Juanita Ann Lenning Frank, 95, Louisville. Gaither Garrett, 91, Louisville. Barbara Greenwell Geyser, 79, Louisville. Debbie Genovese, 74, Louisville. Joan Glass, 82, Danville. Lucille Embry Getz, 81, Madisonville. Kenneth F. Goins, 77, Frankfort. Frank Edward Goodlow, Jr., 87, Newcastle. Joseph Joe Henry Greenwell, 73, Hodgenville. Ralph K. Hammerly, 96, Louisville. Eileen Harrison, 93, Campbellsville. Hobart Andy Hawkins, 34, Big Clifty. Paul D. Hybe, 88, Taylorsville. Faye Ella Hornback, 88, Louisville. David Howell, 64, Hodgenville. Glenn Henry Hubbock, 77, Louisville. Elizabeth Hudson, 40, Louisville. Dolores Ann Hudson, 71, Greenville. Darlene Jones, 62, Greensburg. DeMarcus Lamont Pookey Keene, Sr., 41, Louisville. Glenn Allen Kirby, 86, Louisville. Sharon Klein, 78, Louisville. Rebecca Morgan Colojoco, 31, Mount Washington. Dr. Robert Bob William Korn, 89, Louisville. Stephen Kramer, 69, Louisville. Andrew Lasher, 60, Tell City. John S. Lawrence II, 79, Louisville. Donald Gilbert Lebengood, 80, Louisville. Dwayne Henry Martin, 60, Louisville. George Hill McClure, 73, Louisville. Tristan Andrew McKnight, 37, Madisonville. Mitchell McMillan, 66, Frankfort. Dennis W. Meredith, 78, Jacksonville, Florida. Stephen L. Merker, Ph.D., 81, Louisville. Catherine R. Metcalf, 70, Louisville. Douglas William Metry, 57, Louisville. Herbert Allen Moran, Sr., 75, Louisville. H. Kenneth Kenny Nalia, 75, Louisville. Perry Wayne Knopfsinger, 74, Owensboro. David Emanuel Overton, Sr., 52, Louisville. James W. Owen, Jr., 84, Shepherdsville. Keith D. Pepper, Sr., 76, Louisville. Stella Marie Perkins, 91, Louisville. Mary Lena Porter, 73, Louisville. Charles Edward Price, 92, Louisville. John Price, 24, Livermore. Amy Rollins, 57, Frankfort. Danielle Ray Reed, 52, Shepherdsville. Mary Dolores Reinert, 94, Louisville. Gwendolyn Culp Ridge, 101, Louisville. Kenneth Bradford Roberts, 61, Louisville. Linda King Rose, 83, Owensboro. Christopher Roland, 49, Hazard. Deborah L. Leip Rubenstein, 70, Mount Washington. Elizabeth Betty or Liz Ann Shelton, 91, No City. Joe Nell Shercliffe, 88, Louisville. Geraldine Jerry Simon Snyder, 103, Louisville. Michael Patrick Stewart, 45, Louisville. Ruth Ann Street, 80, Louisville. Joseph A. Sisma, 71, No City. Patricia Pat Thompson, 93, No City. Nancy Sylvius Thompson, 71, KDIS. James Edward Eddie Thompson, 70, Loretto. Bobby Joe Turner, 76, Greensburg. Paul G. Veasley, 76, Louisville. Loretta Wayne Scott, 83, Carrollton. Shirley Catherine White, 73, Simpsonsville. Wendell Jean Whitaker, 79, Hartford. James W. Williams III, 96, Louisville. Virginia L. Wilson, 81, Louisville. William T. Wilson, 86, Louisville. Carol Zuberer, 88, Lenexa, Kansas. If you would like further information about any of the listings today, call us during the weekdays at 859-422-6390, and we will be glad to read the entire item to you. JCPS finalizes dates for 25 high school graduations by Krista Johnson. The Jefferson County Public School District has finalized the date for 25 high school graduations, so long as the district doesn't need to make up any additional school days and the year still ends June 1. The graduations will start the evening of the last day of school and run through Monday, June 5. Read below for the date, time, and location of each high school ceremony. Thursday, June 1 graduations. Eastern, Freedom Hall at 8 p.m. Jeffersontown, Broadbent Arena at 8 p.m. Male, Freedom Hall at 4 p.m. Pathfinder, East Hall at Kentucky Expo Center at 8 p.m. Phoenix, Durrett Auditorium at 5 p.m. Shawnee, seniors will graduate at their school at 5 p.m. Southern, Broadbent Arena at 5 p.m. Valley, seniors will graduate at their school at 5 p.m. Friday, June 2nd, graduations. Ballard, Freedom Hall at 12:30 p.m. Breckenridge, Durrett Auditorium at 3 p.m. Brown, seniors will graduate at their school at 12 p.m. Butler, Freedom Hall at 9 a.m. Central, Broadbent Arena at 9 a.m. Fairdale, Broadbent Arena at 12:30 p.m. Iroquois, Freedom Hall at 7:30 p.m. Manual, Freedom Hall at 4 p.m. Liberty, Durrett Auditorium at 12 p.m. Seneca, Broadbent Arena at 4 p.m. Wagoner, East Hall of Kentucky Expo Center at 12 p.m. Saturday, June 3rd, graduations. Doss, Broadbent Arena at 12:30 p.m. Fern Creek, Broadbent Arena at 9 p.m. PRP, Freedom Hall at 9 a.m. Monday, June 5th, graduations. Atherton, Freedom Hall at 9 a.m. Moore, Freedom Hall at 12:30 p.m. Western, Broadbent Arena at 9 a.m. Get your graduating senior featured in Our Story by Krista Johnson. Hundreds of seniors across Jefferson County are set to take the stage and receive their diplomas next month, an accomplishment the whole community should celebrate. The class of 2023 had the start of their high school careers drastically altered by the COVID-19 pandemic and still managed to succeed in uncharted waters. Given their sacrifices, the Courier-Journal wants to work with Louisville families to honor their hard work. We are collecting letters and baby photos for the class of 2023 to publish in a special online story this June. Aside from sharing what makes you so proud of your graduate, the letters can include advice for college, life, or whatever else you'd like to share before they embark on the next steps in their life. The deadline for the letters accompanied by your favorite childhood photo of your senior is May 31. Please also include your senior's name and school. You can send your submissions by email to kjohnson3@gannett.com. HOPE seeks to encourage Abuse Prevention Board. Francis Praises Efforts to Start Programs in Asia, Africa, Latin America by Nicole Winfield. Pope Francis sought to encourage his embattled Child Protection Advisory Board Friday following weeks of turmoil sparked by the latest resignation of a founding member and fresh questions about its direction. Francis urged his Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors to pursue a spirituality of reparation with abuse survivors and build a culture of safeguarding to prevent priests from raping and molesting children. In particular, he praised the Commission's efforts to establish church child protection programs in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where there's less funding than in the U.S. and Europe. It's not right that the most prosperous areas of the world should have well-trained and well-funded safeguarding programs where victims and their families are respected, while in other parts of the world they suffer in silence, perhaps rejected or stigmatized when they try to come forward to tell of the abuse they have suffered, Francis said. Francis announced the creation of the commission in 2013 to provide best practices advice on combating abuse in the church. The commission has gone through several iterations in the decades since, most significantly with resignations of members frustrated by the resistance of the Vatican bureaucracy to its recommendations and exasperated about the commission's unclear mandate and model. The latest departure was the Reverend Hans Zollner, a German Jesuit who runs a child protection institute at the Pontifical Georgian University in Rome. In a blistering statement March 29th announcing his resignation, Zollner identified a series of internal problems in the commission that he said made it impossible for him to remain. He cited a lack of financial accountability, lack of transparency about decision-making, and lack of clarity about what members are supposed to do and how they're appointed. Zollner's criticisms underscored broader questions about the purpose and direction of the commission, which has never found its place in a Vatican bureaucracy inherently resistant to change and defensive in particular about the abuse dossier. Francis recently moved the commission under the auspices of the Vatican's Diastery Department for the Doctrine of the Faith in a bid to give it institutional legitimacy. But even that has created problems. Critics note that placing the commission under the Diastery, where all abuse cases are processed, was akin to putting a victim's advocacy group inside a federal court. The commission, headed by Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley, has recently moved into fancy new quarters in a downtown Rome palazzo, which it hopes will be used for as a place for victims to be heard and welcomed. In addition, O'Malley told Francis on Friday that the commission had created a fund of 3 million euros to provide safeguarding resources to poorer churches in the developing world. The bulk of that funding, some 2.5 million euros, has come from the Italian Bishops' Conference, which has been criticized repeatedly for its own failures to punish predator priests in Italy and the bishops who shield them. Francis acknowledged the sex abuse scandal had undermined the church's ability to do its core job of spreading the gospel. A culture of safeguarding will only take root if there is pastoral conversation in this regard among the church's leaders, he said. Trust Can Aid Those with Mental Illness by Elizabeth Aiolia. More than 50% of Americans will be diagnosed with a mental illness or disorder during their lifetime, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Chances are some of these individuals will be inheriting wealth at some point. If a family member's mental health issues may interfere with their ability to manage finances, answering these questions could help them create long-term financial stability. Have I set up a trust? Setting up a trust is one way to transfer wealth to a loved one and create financial stability for them. A trust enables you to leave specific instructions for trustees about how to care for your loved one and distribute assets. Trusts can be especially helpful for transferring assets to loved ones who have mental illness but are still able to function independently. While these loved ones are often independent, they may still have difficulty managing assets on their own, says Lily Netchenkor, an attorney who does estate planning in New York. One example includes someone with depression. You can put assets in a trust. Nancor says it can simply be a trust that says this money is to be used to take care of my sister, who is high functioning but is not great with money. Likewise, you can request money be allocated to healthcare expenses and anything else that helps them live a healthy and functioning life. Having a trust in place can also help beneficiaries avoid probate, a court process for handling estates that could be stressful for someone who has a mental illness. Does my loved one receive government assistance? Another important question to ask is whether the person receives government assistance or may need to in the future. While a basic trust may suffice for a loved one who has a mental illness but mostly functions independently, it could negatively impact one who doesn't and receives government assistance. We want to make sure that if we are caring for someone who's receiving that type of benefit, we don't accidentally leave them something that disqualifies them from that benefit, Nancor says. People who receive government assistance may have limits on how much they can have in assets. For instance, to be eligible for supplemental security income through Social Security, they generally can't have resources of more than $2,000 as an individual or $3,000 as a couple. That is, unless you put those assets into a special needs trust. It's an estate planning tool for individuals with disabilities or functional needs. The special needs trust is meant to supplement government benefits that person is receiving. It doesn't replace it. It's meant to supplement it, Nancor says. Nancor says that a standard special needs trust isn't effective until the person who establishes the trust dies. So if you plan to financially support your loved one while you're alive, while they receive benefits, consider setting up a standalone special needs trust. Since setting up a special needs trust can be a complicated process, it's advisable you speak to a professional who specializes in this area. The Special Needs Alliance website has a directory that can point you toward attorneys for special needs planning to help you get started. Have I named the right trustees? The estate managers you name will be responsible for distributing assets to your loved one when you die or you're incapacitated. Talia Utsi, an independent estate planning attorney licensed in Maryland and New York, says a mistake some people make is not appointing the right trustee. She adds that people sometimes take advantage of older adults, young people, and those with mental illness. You have two options, someone you know or a corporate fiduciary. Utsi says if you opt for the former, choose someone who has a good relationship with the beneficiary. You also want to be sure they have some knowledge of estates or can get advice from someone who does. If they are not familiar with estate administration, if they're not familiar with the documents that give them the authority, they're not familiar with their actual authority, then that can be harmful, Utsi says. Alternatively, you may choose to appoint a corporate trustee since they're usually experienced and have no emotional investment. For example, you could use a financial institution like a bank. Just know that corporate fiduciaries often charge heavy fees. Utsi also advises appointing at least one successor trustee, a person who takes over trustee duties, if the initial trustee can't serve. And don't forget to consult with the prospective trustees first, Utsi says. Make sure that the primary and the successor are both interested in taking on that type of responsibility. Is my estate plan clear? To protect your loved one from financial abuse and prevent mishandled funds, you want your plan to be clear and streamlined, Utsi says. This means ensuring all your accounts and assets are addressed to the trust, none are in your loved one's name, and there are clear directions about how money is spent. All assets should flow through the trust if possible. When there's a plan, there's less likelihood of manipulation and funds being wasted because it's clear, it's a process, and it's written down in plain English and black and white, Utsi says. And to some extent, it's a legally enforceable document when it's done the right way. Being clear will also help the trustee execute your plan with ease. Amid the adoration, protests, and ambivalence, Britain's King Charles III receives his crown at Westminster Abbey. By Danica Kirke and Jill Lawless. King Charles III was crowned Saturday at Westminster Abbey, receiving the bejeweled St. Edward's crown in a ceremony built on ancient tradition at a time when the monarchy is striving to remain relevant in fractured modern Britain. Trumpets sounded inside the medieval abbey, and the congregation shouted, "God save the king," at a service attended by more than 2,000 guests, including world leaders, aristocrats, and celebrities. Outside, thousands of troops, tens of thousands of spectators, and a smattering of protesters converged. The crowd of well-wishers swelled to hundreds of thousands by the time the newly crowned Charles and Queen Camilla emerged to wave from the Buckingham Palace balcony alongside younger generations of royals. It was the culmination of a seven-decade journey for the king from heir to monarch. To the royal family and government, the occasion, codenamed Operation Golden Orb, was a display of heritage, tradition, and spectacle unmatched around the world. To the crowds gathered under rainy skies, thousands of whom had camped overnight, it was a chance to be part of a historic occasion. But to millions more, the day was greeted with a shrug, the awe and reverence the ceremony was designed to evoke largely gone. And to a few, it was a reason to protest. Hundreds who want to see Britain become a republic gathered to holler, "Not my king." They see the monarchy as an institution that stands for privilege and inequality, in a country of deepening poverty and fraying social ties. A handful were arrested. As the day began, the abbey buzzed with excitement and was abloom with fragrant flowers and colorful hats as the congregation of international dignitaries, nobles, and other notables arrived. Among them were Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, 8 current and former British prime ministers, judges in wigs, soldiers with gleaming medals, and celebrities including Judi Dench, Emma Thompson, and Lionel Richie. President Joe Biden, who didn't attend the ceremony, said in a tweet that the enduring friendship between the U.S. and the U.K. is a source of strength for both our peoples. First Lady Jill Biden, who was representing the U.S., said it was an honor to be at the Westminster Abbey on this historic day. French President Emmanuel Macron, who attended the coronation ceremony with his wife Bridget, expressed his congratulations to King Charles III and Queen Camilla, friends of France. "Proud to be by your side on this historic day," he posted on Twitter. During the traditional Anglican service, slightly tweaked for modern times, Charles, clad in crimson and cream robes, swore on a Bible that he is a true Protestant. But a preface was added to the coronation oath to say the Church of England will seek to foster an environment where people of all faiths and beliefs may live freely. And the epistle from the King James Bible was read by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, Britain's first Hindu leader. A gospel choir performed a newly composed Alleluia, and for the first time, female clergy took part in the ceremony. It was also the first to include representatives of the Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim, and Sikh faiths. In an ancient display of kingly power, Charles was anointed with oil from the Mount of Olives in the Holy Land, a part of the ceremony so sacred it was concealed behind screens and presented with an orb, swords, and scepters. Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby then placed the solid gold crown bedecked with more than 400 precious stones on Charles's head while he sat in the 700-year-old oak coronation chair. Underneath the seat was a sacred slab known as the Stone of Scone on which ancient Scottish kings were crowned. For 1,000 years and more, British monarchs have been crowned in such a grandiose ceremonies that confirm their right to rule. Charles was the 40th sovereign to be enthroned in the abbey, and at 74, the oldest. These days, the king no longer has executive or political power, and the service is purely ceremonial, since Charles automatically became king upon death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, in September. The king does remain the UK's head of state and a symbol of national identity, and Charles will have to work to bring together a multicultural nation and shore up support for the monarchy at a time when it's waning, especially among younger people. Today's public is very different from the audience that saw Elizabeth crowned. Almost 20% of the population now comes from ethnic minority groups, compared with less than 1% in the 1950s, and less than half of the population described themselves as Christian. The anti-monarchy group Republic said 6 of its members, including its chief executive, were arrested as they arrived at a protest. Police, who had warned that they would have a low tolerance for people seeking to disrupt the day, said 4 people were arrested on suspicion of conspiracy to cause a public nuisance. The notoriously feuding royal family put on its own show of unity. Heir to the throne, Prince William, his wife Kate, and their 3 children were all in attendance. Towards the end of the ceremony, William knelt before his father and pledged
loyalty to the king before kissing him on the cheek. Then Welby invited everyone in the abbey to swear true allegiance to the monarch. William's younger brother, Prince Harry, who has publicly sparred with the family, arrived alone. His wife Meghan and their children remained at home in California. Large crowds cheered as Charles and Camilla rode in the gold state carriage from the Abbey to Buckingham Palace, accompanied by a procession of 4,000 troops and military bands playing jaunty tunes. As the King and Queen waved to a sea of people outside the palace, the Royal Air Force aerobatic team, the Red Arrows, sped overhead, trailing red, white, and blue plumes. "It's just to be surrounded by love and to see our King Charles. He's our mainstay," said Jill Coughlin, a royal fan from Essex, east of London. "We loved our Queen, and this is just further generations. So it's wonderful for us. Absolutely wonderful." This concludes excerpts from the Courier Journal for Sunday, May 7th, 2023. Your reader has been Melody Ryan. Stay tuned for continued programming on Radio Y.